Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine that we've been reading, and this is about country music stars, and it's the story of America and their views. So we're going to begin with Senator Mike Crapo. Country music became comforting music for me, especially in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. While our nation faced its worst terrorist attack on American soil, Americans united together and lifted each other up in unprecedented ways. The song that has stuck with me since is Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. The themes of that song resonate broadly for any number of issues, including now as we watch Russia's barbaric attacks on Ukraine. Senator Mike Crapo, 71, is a Republican from Idaho. Next, Sammy Hager. My father is from Texas, and he listened to country music. So when I was 3 or 4 years old, riding in the car, he had the radio on, and he would be whistling or he would be yodeling. He was listening to Gene Autry, Hank Snow, and Hank Williams. I would sing along to those songs. That's how I became a singer. I've just recorded a rock record at the old RCA studio in Nashville. Every time we took a break, I went out into the lobby and looked at the pictures on the wall. I saw Dolly Parton with Porter Wagoner, and I saw Johnny Cash. I was just mesmerized by that. I wasn't going around seeing if Judas Priest was there. Sammy Hagar, 74, has a new album, These Crazy Times, planned for release this year. Senator Marsha Blackburn. One of my favorite moments in Washington was having Garth Brooks come to accept the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for popular song. Capitol Hill can be a real circus, but when Garth walks into a room, you forget all of that and focus on the great times you're about to have. As Americans, we are bound by common values: faith, family, freedom, hope, and opportunity. And it's those deeply human moments that help us find deeper connections that transcend geography. There's no such thing as flyover country when a music lover in New York or L.A. can hit play on a Jason Aldean song and suddenly find solace on a back road they didn't even know existed. There's your common ground. Senator Marsha Blackburn, 70, is a Republican from Tennessee. And finally in this article, Robin Mead. As a journalist, I'm attracted to story songs. How many hundreds of times have you heard The Gambler? But you will still listen to it all the way through like you didn't know the story. I remember in a time of my life suffering through panic attacks at the start of newscasts when I was a news anchor in Chicago. I'd spend time off the air worrying about whether I would be racked with jagged breath and a palpitating heart. To keep my brain in the moment, I listened to Faith Hill. It's hard to feel anxious when you're singing This Kiss. Robin Mead, 53, is the anchor of HLN's Morning Express. She has also recorded 2 country albums. Now next, from AARP, the magazine, there's an article, What to Eat When You're In, and it lists a lot of different cities and states. So I'm not going to read them all, but I thought we might be interested in what they say we should eat in North Carolina. If you like fried shrimp, try blowfish tails. In the spring, just about every seafood shack fries these up by the bushel. They're usually a few ounces each and have a clean whitefish flavor. If you like Spam, try liver mush. It tastes better than its name suggests. Made of seasoned ground pork and liver mashed with cornmeal mush, it is molded into blocks and then sliced and pan-fried. If you like pie, try sonker. Dating to Scottish immigrants in the early 1700s, this hot, fruity dessert, topped with a sugary crust, is usually made with blueberries, though sometimes other juicy fruits or even sweet potatoes are used. Surrey County has its own sugar trail with 8 spots, including a few bakeries, restaurants, and a general store where you can dig into it with a spoon. I've lived in North Carolina a long time, and I don't believe I've had any of those things. Now, from AARP, the Bulletin, we've been reading articles on caregiving. And we have a separate article here about a caregiving starter guide. 5 steps that can help you prepare for this important role. It's kind of a summary, I think. Step 1, pre-plan. Having that first "we should talk about caregiving" discussion can be uncomfortable, especially if you're dealing with a parent, someone with a long history of providing care, not needing it. Look for an opening to raise the issue. A useful technique is to bring up an article you read on the topic, such as the ones on these pages. I was just reading about some of the challenges of long-term care. We've never talked about that. What do you think we should do to prepare? But here's the key. When they tell you their thoughts, listen. One way to help them maintain that sense of pride is to ensure that their wishes will be supported. Don't make any plans for caregiving without their involvement. Money is a major concern, too. So as the conversations progress, you will need an assessment of your family's finances and eventually access to statements and other financial records. If you encounter resistance to having a conversation, consider recruiting a helper, another family member, a trusted friend, a faith leader, or even a doctor. Your loved one might be more open with another person, and that person can act as a broker to further conversations. Step 2. Write a plan. A caregiving plan doesn't have to be expansive or fancy, and you can't anticipate every scenario. But taking your loved one's wishes and crafting a plan on paper will help you think through the necessary tasks. The plan should be broken into sections, with immediate needs and then anticipated short-term and long-term needs. Step 3. Form your team. Get out of your head any notion that you can do it all on your own. Start thinking of who can help, even if it's just small tasks. Team members need not all live nearby or have large blocks of time to contribute. If someone in your family is good with household finances, enlist that person to take care of paying bills. A friendly neighbor can do morning coffee check-ins. Others may be available to offer rides. Step 4. Find support. Family and friends can be tremendous resources, but caregiving also requires the help of professionals, others to consult. Your area agency on aging should be your first call. It can help guide you to other local resources that can help, such as home-delivered meals, transportation services, adult daycare, and more. To find your area agency on aging, go to eldercare.acl.gov. Go to a nurse or social worker. These people can offer guidance on your loved one's health and emotional needs. Your employer may offer an employee assistance program that can help you locate this type of professional. Or check with your agency, your area agency, on aging, or find services at eldercare.acl.gov, or by calling 800-677-1116. One important step, have a doctor or nurse run through all the medications your loved one takes and show you how to provide any needed in-home care. You could also go to home health aides. paid workers can come to your loved one's home to help with bathing, dressing, housekeeping, laundry, and meal preparation. Services vary by provider. If you can't afford to hire an aide, check with your area agency on aging to see if financial support may be available through a nonprofit organization. Or go to a handyman. You may need to make your loved one's home safer. Some of these changes could be simple, such as bringing in an adjustable shower seat. But others could require some skills, such as installing handrails and grab bars, improving the lighting, or putting on a video monitoring system. Step 5. Care for yourself. If this hasn't been made clear already, caregiving is a difficult job and can be overwhelming, so it's important to remember to take care of the caregiver too. Find out if your employer offers leave for caregiving. Hopefully, it's paid time off, but even unpaid leave can help if you can afford it. Or ask about flexible working hours or remote work opportunities. Be honest with your employer about your situation and discuss what arrangements can be made. Understand the financial impact that caregiving will have on you as early as possible. Budget for these costs when making a plan to help avoid stress later. Allow yourself to take breaks. Do not ignore your own needs or for exercise, sleep, and healthy eating. Ask others to take on more responsibility temporarily when needed. Consider joining a support group. You can find one through your area agency on aging or at eldercare.acl.gov. These can be in-person meetings or online communities. Caregivers find that talking with others who are experiencing or have experienced similar stresses can be helpful. This article was adapted from AARP Family Caregiving Guide. You can go to aarp.org/caregiving/prepare-2-care-planning-guide. Moving on to the complete guide to memory, and this is by Centennial Health. We're on to a new chapter now, Anatomy of a Memory. In this Q&A, Elizabeth Loftus, the world's preeminent expert on implanted and false recollection, explains why our narratives are malleable and often in flux. In the sidebar item, powerful studies suggest that if a memory has been recovered during the course of therapy, we should confirm that memory with someone else who was there at the time. We like to think of memory as reliable and permanent, like a photograph that doesn't fade or a recording device that simply plays back when we push a button. Elizabeth Loftus forever changed that view. Her 4 decades of groundbreaking research show that human memory is malleable. It is like a Wikipedia page, open to editing by ourselves and others. Loftus is now one of the most famous psychologists alive, a distinguished professor at the University of California, Irvine, holding dual appointments in criminology and psychology. She has authored over 20 books and 500 scientific papers. She is also one of the most controversial figures in what is known as the memory wars. Can you recover buried memories you had suppressed for decades? Is a recovered memory evidence enough to convict and jail someone, even decades later? Some advocates insist that one can, indeed, completely bury traumatic memories and later recover them fully intact. Others contend that such memories, often obtained with the help of visualizations and hypnosis, are false. They are imaginings that feel true. Loftus's work on the fallibility of memory has shown how common and how powerful false memories are. Loftus has been hailed as a hero and also decried as a villain for her work on memory. She has testified as an expert witness in over 300 court cases, including cases where individuals were wrongly jailed based on eyewitness testimony that involved false memories. Loftus has demonstrated that we can create convincing memories of events that never occurred. Nevertheless, debates on the nature of memory rage on. Here, we ask Loftus about her most famous studies and cases. And a little bit about her. She is the most important psychologist of the 20th century, according to the Review of General Psychology. She has revolutionized our understanding of memory. So, question. You did some remarkable work in the 70s, showing that how we ask questions can influence someone's memory of what occurred. These are called leading questions. Tell us about that. We showed people photos of crimes or accidents, such as a car crash, and later asked them questions about what they had seen. We asked them to estimate how fast the cars were going when they hit each other or when they smashed into each other. Just using the word smashed caused them to guess the cars were going faster. And when we used the word smashed, nearly one-third told us they remembered seeing broken glass in the accident scene, whereas there was no broken glass at all. That showed a mere word could influence how someone remembered an event. This is important because police interrogators often use leading questions. Next question. Not long after that, you showed that you could actually plant entirely false memories in someone's mind. Answer. An older relative was enlisted to describe four events that happened to someone when they were a child, including getting lost in a mall at age 5 or 6, and being frightened and crying. After just a few suggestive interviews, about a quarter of the people came to develop a partial or complete memory of being lost in a mall. Later, in Canada, researchers were able to plant a memory in half of participants about being attacked by a vicious animal as a child. What are the real-world consequences of false memories? The consequences can be terrible. One project looked at 300 innocent defendants who were convicted of crimes they did not commit, and some of them spent up to 30 years in prison. Later, DNA tests showed they were innocent. When those cases were analyzed, about 70% were due to faulty eyewitness memory. One of the most tragic cases I worked on involved an innocent man named Steve Titus. He was a 31-year-old restaurant manager who was pulled over because his car resembled that of a man who had raped a female hitchhiker earlier in the evening. The police took a picture of Titus and showed it to the victim in a photo lineup. She said of his picture, "That one's the closest." But during the trial, she got on the stand and said, "I'm absolutely positive that's the man." How did her memory become crystallized with such certainty? Titus was convicted. His fiance collapsed on the courtroom floor, sobbing. He was sent to jail. He called up the local newspaper, and an investigative journalist pursued the case and found the real rapist, who was thought to have committed 50 rapes in the area. Titus was set free, but by that time he had lost his job, savings, and fiancé, and was so embittered he filed a lawsuit. At age 35, he died of a stress-induced heart attack. So, in a sense, Titus was killed by someone else's false memory. Tell us about the famous case that actually launched the memory wars. Answer. A young mother named Eileen Franklin recovered a memory of her father murdering her best friend in front of her as an 8-year-old child. The father was prosecuted, and he was convicted by the jury and sent to prison on the basis of that memory. However, later the conviction was overturned. Fascination with this case has never died. In 2021, a 4-part Showtime documentary called Buried told the entire story again. The idea was that you could wall off a collection of traumatic memories and be completely unaware of them, but then later reliably recover them in therapy. But there is no credible evidence for the idea of a massive repression like that. Not long after, in the 1990s, that idea became an entire movement. Patients were going into therapy for a problem like depression, anxiety, or an eating disorder, and recovering buried memories of horrific molestation, rape, and even satanic ritualistic abuse. A popular book at the time was called The Courage to Heal, A Guide for Women Survivors, and it encouraged using guided imagery to access what they believed were buried memories. We'll continue with this one next time. Now on to AARP The Bulletin, again a different issue. This is Q&A with Ice-T. Small decisions change the trajectory of your life. From hustler to rap icon to Law & Order star, Ice-T, 64, describes his unique American journey. You start out as a street hustler, then a hip-hop star. Now you've played a cop on Law & Order Special Victims Unit for 20 years. Does that all feel odd to you? At first it did. When I was first a cop in the 1991 film New Jack City, I thought that was a career suicide. I didn't really know how people would accept it. But it's acting. If they cast a street cat as a street cat, that's not real acting. But if you cast me as a cop, you get a cop with a very interesting dynamic. Are you going to continue with SVU? SVU has been picked up for the 24th season. That's been my day job, which has given me a solid career where I'm home. I've got my kid, I've got my wife. It's not like a record where you put it out and cross your fingers. What's next for your music career? As far as making music, I'm aware they are never going to play an Ice-T record on the radio. I'm out of the loop. Hip-hop hits between ages 15 and 25. That's the audience. But me and Big Daddy Kane and Wu-Tang Clan and Nas will be touring forever. I always think of it like Frank Sinatra. People just want to come out and hear our catalog. I just make records because I love it. How have you been staying healthy? That's been me my whole life. I don't smoke. I don't even smoke weed. I don't drink. I'm pretty straight edged. I've got a young wife, model Coco Austin. That helps too. And you are a family man. I have a 6-year-old daughter, Chanel. When she was born, the very first thing that came to my mind was, you just can't die. You've got to take care of yourself. You just can't get away with the stuff you got away with in your 20s and 30s. By 50, no mistakes allowed, because it takes longer to recover. Your new book, Split Decision, is candid about your youthful crimes. What advice would you give that younger self now? I would say to myself that there are other options. When people are breaking the law, they don't really see any other option. You become street poisoned, like writer Iceberg Slim says. You start to believe that anything legit is for squares and suckers. The only lanes that seemed open to me were hustling. Those were the only people around me I saw getting money. When hip-hop hit in the 1980s, it opened a lot of lanes for a lot of kids. And today? Now there are tons of options. There are all kinds of things you can do. But I was pre-internet. As opportunities opened up, there's less reason for people to go to jail. I'm looking at kids now and thinking there's no way they need to do some of the stuff we were doing. So, hip-hop was a way off the street? I knew what I was doing wasn't going to last. Cats I admired were getting life sentences and getting shot. I was looking for a way out. First, I went into the Army. That was my first attempt to try to get out of the game. Then, hip-hop was intriguing to me. A lot of my hustler friends said, "Why are you wasting your time? You need to get this money." I was just aware that if I went down that path, I was eventually going to die or go to prison. And once you were straight, that was it? When I made the decision that I was done, I didn't jaywalk. I had broken enough laws for everybody we know. Now that I had this chance of getting to the other side, I honestly believe that if I were to do something illegal or cross somebody, I would die. I think that I would suffer instant karma. Now, I'm square as a pool table and twice as green, man. Do you miss anything? Nah, I'm straight. My boys told me, Ice, you pulled the biggest heist on life. You're the police now. You pulled the biggest one ever. Your new book is co-written with a friend of yours from your hustling days, Spike, who ended up in prison after he took part in a robbery that ended in a murder. Spike came home after 26 years. He came out and said, I want to write a book. I thought about it and said, do you know what makes you special? Me, because you and I were on the same path and we made different decisions. So I'll write the book with you. This book is really a cautionary tale. What is your message? That life is based on crossroads that we choose from every day. Small decisions change the trajectory of your life. Coming from two live cats, don't do it. Don't test the criminal justice system. Kids think that since we are older, they are a little smarter than us, and they won't make the same mistakes. Well, the cops are smart too. Everything you think that they don't know, trust me, somebody has gotten caught and told them. And finally, how important to you are old friendships like yours and Spike's? To me, one of the true tests of character in a person is solidarity. I've got friends from high school and junior high. My only rule is to never cross me. Again, that was from an interview with Ice-T. Okay, we have just a few minutes left today for some more of these 99 hints for saving money. And we're on groceries now. Yes, order online. What you might lose in delivery costs often is more than made up by avoiding impulse purchases when browsing a store. The trick? Lower your delivery costs. Look for coupons at sites like couponfollow.com to find deals, such as $20 off your first order at Vons, 15% off Kroger grocery shipments, and $10 off your first delivery of $20 at Instacart. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.